I guess it was a year or two ago, I spoke to you on chimney sweeps, some of you. I'm Ernie Gerlach. It's a pleasure to be here to introduce our speaker today. I've been sitting at the table with our speaker, Chuck Valverde, learning a bit about his past and his family. I was prepared to introduce him as a graduate from San Diego State in 1959. He worked in higher education for a while as an assistant to the Vice Chancellor for Business and Finance at Tri-University System in the early 70s. But in addition, as I sit at the table, he starts to recall me of tales of the Valverde family, and I find that the Valverdes came from the shores of Corsica, the long line of pirates, who a few years ago were stranded in San Diego. And I guess the tales could go on. I remember Warren Brocks when I first began to drop by San Diego, sort of wander around the streets of San Diego when I was going to San Diego High School, and kind of wander in the late 60s and early 70s into bookstores downtown San Diego. I never thought I'd be introducing Chuck Valverde. Known him for many years now. He's collecting books up and down throughout Southern California. He periodically sends books or problems my way, which I think about for a bit, and then I ask him what I should do. So he's a kind of a source of always bringing interest in books to me, and I usually end up going back to him for the advice. I'd like to introduce Chuck Valverde. He's going to be speaking to us this afternoon. Ramblings and Reminiscences of a Southern California Book Dealer. Chuck.
First, we have to do a sound check because I have a monologue, and the last thing my wife said to me early this morning was, make sure you speak up. So can we be heard back there? Thank you very much. I think probably we should start, this is the age of the disclaimer, and everybody's concerned about legalities, and so you mentioned the word graduation from this institution, and I think we should probably say something about, there was a paper submitted to me sometime around the late 50s, but it was more of a do not trespass again or do not impersonate a student rather than a graduate. Before we start rambling on, as an outside observer for a number of years to the friends, let me tell you what I have observed and what I have seen. Progressing. And number one, and I don't remember when I became involved with the friends, but watching and reading the newsletters, I have seen coming together a stronger group of people, recently having published what I consider an extraordinary book, other books on this schedule, meetings to enhance the university library, which is, I'm sure, what the charter reads. But I think there's something else I see coming out of this group, and that is essentially that there is now a voice, a strong voice, as a friend speaking for the library, and this is too as it should be. But I'm looking, frankly, at the problems which we have with libraries, and essentially that is with budgets. And I know that this is a sad thing to say, but very frankly, the first time there is a budget crunch, the library is the one that receives it first. Not just State College or the University College Library, but it happens with our city libraries, and our county libraries, and the libraries. And I think perhaps because those people involved in budget and budget preparations are political, to be sure, but they are trying to reduce operational costs in those areas where perhaps there is the least verbal resistance. And so now when I say to you that as an organization you have a voice, why, this I think is so much better for the university. This voice can be heard by the administrators, by the people in Sacramento, or wherever they happen to be. And I happen to think this is a very good thing. The only thing I would hope is that somebody from somewhere within the organization has something of a command of Anglo-Saxons that can help the people necessary to understand. But I'm proud of you, and you all should be congratulated on your efforts and the great things that are going on. To start, and you notice I didn't bring a large number of pieces of paper because that always scares people, and the exit is usually pretty rapid. I want to take you back for a few minutes, back to the summer of 1935 in San Diego. And there was, and people are oftentimes amazed that there truly was a Warren Brock. And yes, there was. He was, in 1935, a graduate of Pomona University. He had a degree in literature and the fine arts. And if you can visualize 1935, we were just coming out of depression, and there wasn't a lot of demand for someone with a degree in literature. But he was back in San Diego. His family was a San Diegan. His father was a very well-known man in our community who worked for the post office, very active in church and civic organizations. And Vernon now, as a young man graduated, looked about and found not a lot of opportunity. He chose to look upon the opportunity that he did see, that being in books. He did choose to think that he could become a bookseller in a community where there weren't many booksellers and there weren't many demand for books. And with that, and a few books in inventory, and some personal books from his family and friends, and a very few dollars, he rented a space, a storefront, at what is now 9th and Broadway. Presently there is a high-rise senior citizen facility there, very nice looking. At that time, they were single-story storefronts. And he opened up in early midsummer of 1935 what is Warren Brock's Book House. Now, it didn't resemble a house, but most of the books that were in it had come from family and friends in his own house. So this was an appropriate name at the time. And he proceeded to prosper and do business as best you could in those kind of lean years. But things did progress, and he increased his inventory as the meager funds allowed, and he bought sparingly as he could and where he could find books. So the inventory increased, there were used magazines, and one day a call came in saying that a very large library was going to be disposed of in the, I believe, the Point Loma area. And would he be interested in buying it? And yes, he would be interested in buying it. And they made an evening appointment, and shortly prior to leaving to Point Loma, he took all of the receipts for the last several days of business, and all of his money, his lunch money that he'd saved, and what few dollars he had in his pocket, and he put that in his trousers, and he went out to Point Loma with $65 in change. And he came upon a large house which had indeed a fine library, and which, unfortunately, the husband and wife were going to separate. And even in 1935, I guess people did that sort of thing. They were going to separate, and so the contents of the house, including the books, were for sale, and he was asked to evaluate it, which he did, and he looked very sternly into the eye of the owner, and he said, "These are nice books, they are extraordinary books, but indeed I couldn't pay you more than $65 for them," which he did. And this was the start of Warren Brock's having a little better book. Books and Warren Brock's seemed to find each other. He was a master at finding good books, and he bought them, continued to prosper. The years leading up to the war years, found him looking at, because of the increase in business, at a new location. He acquired the building, or part of the building, in the Bank of America building at 7th and Broadway. He contracted that for that in early 1942. The war years was just starting, the war efforts were starting, but he continued to do two things. Run a bookstore, and work for the Navy Department in the form of a civilian worker for the war effort. Working long hours, I might say, and the business prospered. I'd like to stop just a moment and tell you that along about this time, a number of individuals entered into the life of Vernon Warren Brock in the form of employees. Perhaps the first man to come along was a man by the name of Howard Brown, a name that probably will not ring many bells for the bibliophiles of the community. Howard had, for some unknown reason, acquired a tremendous interest in scholarly periodicals, journals, even back issues of some magazines. And this was, for many years, a large part of Vernon's business. He came along as a specialist in this area and continued to work. Mid-more years found another gentleman by the name of Lafayette Young. Lafayette Young will, I think, perhaps ring some bells, because for many years it was the firm of Lafayette Young's used books downtown. Lafayette was a true bibliophile. If those of you who have ever read Vindius Nin's diaries, you'll remember that there is referred to throughout Laf, the poet. And this was Lafayette Young. In the period of the Paris, in the 30s, when the expatriates were holding forth, Lafayette Young was among them as the local poet, partaking of the poetry and the wine of the communities that he happened to be visiting. Wonderful man, returned to San Diego, started working for Warren Brocks, and later went off on his own. Finally, the third key employee for Warren Brocks in the war years was a man by the name of Joe Herwig. And Joe, I think everybody knows, he's recently retired, but he came from the Hawaiian Islands to San Diego, worked for Warren Brocks, and eventually went off on his own. Well, this consortium of individuals who were working for Vernon Warren Brocks started with the idea that they could build, with Vernon's help, a large, big bookstore with general interest books and fine quality books. Not rare books, but interesting books, both new and used. And this was the theme that carried forth up until the period that they started leaving. And as every bookstore has, and I think every bookstore should, there will be those employees who will come to work and learn the business and then move along. The war ended, business continued. The 9th Avenue store was closed because now they had cut a hole into the floor to make more room in the basement of their 7th Avenue store. And there was an interesting phenomenon that occurred, and it was simply called a paperback book. The problem so many of the older booksellers have and had was that a book is a book if it has a hardcover, but if a paperback book is around, why, that is really an imposter. It's not truly a book. And so many of my peers in this business have a problem today with the paperback book. It's not truly a book, but it's around. Vernon Warren Brock had the foresight to think that this was a phenomenon, and so he cut this big hole in the floor, created a basement, filled with new paperback books, and was continually successful in that line. The interesting thing about that time, Romans, if some of you remember Romans on 6th Avenue, did the same thing, created a paperback department, which for many years was used as the example of what a good paperback department should be in various books on books. Well, that brings us up into the late 60s, the middle 60s at any rate, and I have to tell you about my friend Warren Brock, who, by the way, is still alive, living in Escondido, and I'll come back to him in a bit. But Vernon drove a motorcycle. Now, I have to stop and tell you also that all booksellers have these little quirks. Vernon's was a motorcycle. He had gone to Europe and found the first, I think, opposed cylinder motorcycle, and brought it back to this country, first one in California, and drove it to his home daily in Pine Valley, back and forth. Unfortunately, there was an accident, as I think happens to everybody on a motorcycle, and Vernon had at that time, a porcelain hip put in because of the accident required this to be done. Vernon, and any bookseller, is a very active person, and you stand a great deal, and with a hip with a problem, why, it becomes quite difficult. So Vernon started at that time toying with the story, with the store and the process of selling it. I got to stop here again. These little stories are going to pop in and out. And when I tell them, it's because I want you to understand the kind of bookseller that was among you for so many years. Vernon came down to visit me here just a few months ago. He had a doctor's appointment at a university hospital because a series of doctors from around this part of the country wanted to look at his hip through x-rays and so on, because he has the oldest porcelain implanted hip in the world. Everybody else has had it changed to steel or plastic. Vernon kept his porcelain hip. Now, that I think is an interesting story in itself, but we were visiting and talking and reminiscing, and it got to be about 11:45, and he looked at the clock and said, "Oh my goodness, I have to check into the hospital at exactly 12 o'clock. Can you give me a cab?" And I said, "Well, I'll do better than that. I'll give you a ride up to the University Hospital." "Well, that would be fine," he said. And on the way up there, because there was a great bit of concern that he would get there by noon, I said, "Vernon, why is it that you have to check in by 12? And he said, "Well, you see, if I don't check in by 12, I don't get lunch. His son, by the way, is the dean of students at the UCSD Medical School and a teacher there also in anesthesiology. And we meet once a year on purpose to keep up with the Vernon Warnbach stories. So Vernon decided in the, I lose track of time on this point, but I have to stop and think a minute. It's 79 now. So. In the later, middle 60s, to dispose of the store. But he wasn't going to sell the store to just anyone. And here I feel very honored. There are a number of people out there that wanted to buy the store and wanted to work in it, but this wouldn't do. But he did approach a man who was a local businessman and said, well, if you find an acceptable man to run the store, I will sell it to you at the agreed price. Well, this happened. And so I was allowed to come down and run Warnbach's bookstore. And eventually buy an interest in it through the organization that I was in. And Vernon, in turn, had the opportunity to stay as an employee of his own store and observe me. And let me tell you that there are a lot of sleepless nights on that. One of the great thoughts he had was that there was never enough emphasis given to cleaning the books. That at every turn in the store aisle, there should be hanging on a hook a feather duster. Now, not just one of these ones made out of plastic, but truly a feather duster with the pheasant feathers and long ones. And this should be used. In fact, it should be in your pocket, but it's not being used. And so he took great delight in coming in and saying, I think I found some dust. And he did. I'm going to stop the story again and tell you that about 1970, what would be the equivalent of the American Medical Association, but for Britain. Somebody there looked and started reading obituaries, and they wondered why these antiquarian booksellers were living beyond the time of the norm, and indeed were dying not of natural causes, but were reading a book while they crossed the street and getting hit by a truck, or falling off of ladders and things like this. And so, with nothing much else to do, they did a study on the British antiquarian bookseller as to why do these rather unique individuals live so long. And it was a scholarly study. There was some real work in it. And they determined really just three or four things. That one, that man doesn't retire. He doesn't hit a stage in his life where he is required to quit work. Indeed, he continues to work, and he continues to work and be very interested in what he's doing. Every day is a challenge, every day is a search, and he is, in addition to all of that, he is physically very active, and they figured this was the reason for the longevity. Now, Vernon Warnbach sold the store and essentially retired in the middle 60s. Since that time, he's opened a store in San Rafael, run it for a number of years, and sold it. He retired for a year or so and did some traveling and opened up another store in Ventura, California, and ran that for a while. You notice there's a little progression southward here. And here, just a few years ago, he ran that for a number of years and sold it. And now he opened up a store about 4 years ago in Oceanside. And he then later was unable to sell that store, but he did dispose of the inventory. And he is settled now in Escondido. Now, I fully expect there to be a store with the name Warnbach somewhere between Claremont and Escondido or Fallbrook in the near future. In between all of these businesses, why he has traveled a great deal, extensive. For those of you who don't know him, I think it's your loss. He's a delightful, wonderful, entertaining bookman who I choose to consider very lucky to have known and worked with before. But that brings us up to the time when I acquired the store. Now, the first couple of years, we, and I say we because I was involved in a mini conglomerate. There were two stores, two businesses. I ran one, my associate ran the other. And we struggled and thrashed around, and someone finally said that, you know, it wasn't necessary to make a profit if we were going to see the light of the next business year. And we did, we struggled and continued to make a little profit. And in the process, why we acquired another business, not book businesses, different businesses. But that's another story. about 3 or 4 years into the book business, I found that buying and selling new and used books was fine, and it's a wonderful way to consider a livelihood. But it is limited in what you can do. How much volume can you do? Because as you increase your volume, you increase your overhead. And I don't have to get into the mathematics of that, but while you make more money, while you spend more, and you come out about the same. But as luck would have it, one day, in travels, somehow, we found what is called a whaling logbook. And this isn't the kind of book we had ever handled before. This was the narrative of a man who had sailed a whaling vessel out of New Brunswick, who kept in his own diary a hand holograph form, the writings of things that occurred, how many whales were killed, how much rat and blubber were removed, what hardships they experienced, and what, at that time, what current events were made available to them. It was his logbook. And I knew this had to have some value, but I didn't know. It wasn't like any other book we had. And visiting us one time was a man whom you all know by the name of Jacob Zeitlin, of the firm of Zeitlin and Verbogi, rare book dealers, longtime member of the Friends of the Library and on the advisory board of this particular Friends group. And Jacob showed me how to sell a book, how to research it, work on it. And as a matter of fact, he did a great deal of work. And for this, he took a fee, as he should. But it opened up a whole new world. We turned around and had, rather than the new and the used books, well, here was a whole new area of books that were really hard to get, can be very expensive, and books that would offer a different approach to book selling. And we pursued this. What it left us was essentially an opportunity to sell the books in the general bookstore that we have, the new used books that we buy and sell. But by opening up our inventory, investing in more expensive books, it allowed us to do cataloging and reach a rare book market. I find this most interesting, but I can never, and would I ever, make mention of the fact that Warner Brothers has always been a store that has new books, used books of every variety. And that, frankly, is our bread and butter, and I always think that it should be. It should be the kind of thing that gets our first attention and everything else the second. Probably one of the big traumatic movements of my life as pertains to book business was 6 years ago, yesterday as a matter of fact, why we had to move a bookstore that was housed in 4,500 square feet, many thousands and thousands of volumes of books. As every bookstore is faced with, and frankly it's one of the big problems with bookstores in any community, that the bookseller is unable to pay the rent that the landlord and he is forced to move or demise. We were fortunate enough to have a place within a half a block of our old location, and so the logistics were simply to remodel and physically move. And here San Diego State University comes into play, because we were moving at the Christmas time. And the logistics were very simple. Why, we had a warehouse off in the warehouse district, the shelving was made, the new building was remodeled, the shelving moved in, and now all we had to do was move these thousands of books in order. And so I contacted the athletic department at San Diego State University. And I was told that, yes, they had some athletes available, because we needed athletes, because these were big and heavy boxes that they'd be moving. We needed some strong fellas, but the basketball was in progress, and we couldn't use those fellas. And the baseball guys weren't in shape. And the football guys, nobody knew where they were. But how about taking my soccer team? And so I was prevailed upon, and I said, all right, we'll use, I can't remember what it was, 11 or 14 of your soccer players, and we'll put them to work for this amount of time moving books. And the first man to show up that morning we started to move was this high. Had a very slight built, and probably one of the best soccer players that you've come along here. But anyway, as I looked at him outside the door and he's standing there, I'm here to work, I thought, uh-oh, I think I've got big problems. But the balance of these boys showed up, And they moved Warren Brock's bookstore over the Cross of Christmas. It was done by using four-wheel carts, driving half a block, and these young men divided themselves into teams, and they would race with these carts across the street. Now, I just was sure that they were going to run into a car full of nuns and that the whole thing was a disaster. But the interesting part of it is that they were a literate bunch of young men. They were good students. We still hear it from a lot of them. One of them getting his PhD in behavioral psychology in England. He was a Jewish boy. Another young man from Guatemala who dropped out of school for a year to go back and help with the problems there. Just several young men who have kept in touch who were just delightful and tremendous help. We got written up in several national magazines as to moving this way. I will conclude this short story with telling you that moving one bookstore is equal to three floods and two fires in any bookstore. It's something you just don't want to do. Well, I'm taking you through the history, and it's a brief history of this store. I think I can't continue without saying a little bit about the people who work for us. And I don't know that we've borrowed anything from the so-called Japanese form of management that has been so popular in books, at least, and perhaps in practical application. But in our store, and I think to Brunnen Degree's credit, people who work for Warren Brock are totally involved in what they do. We have a situation where they come to work, they learn, they progress to a point where they then become specifically involved in doing one thing. We have one fellow who's a bibliographer and he does a lot of just the typing and referencing of books. But we like to get him to do other things. But that is principally his job. Another fellow who's just in charge of stock and he tries to get the right book on the right space on the shelf, and sometimes he succeeds there because it's a hard job. And they all become involved, they all are involved in decision making, and they all share the profits. And if at any time the opportunity has comes along that they can leave and start a store or acquire a store of their own, they are so encouraged to do that. I've had three young men leave me and go on, I think, to great success within the book business. One, Jim Lindstrom, who is the present proprietor of the Lafayette Young Garden Bookstore downtown, and a delightful gentleman, a very good bibliophile, who worked for Warren Brock for a number of years before going there. Another gentleman who worked for me not long enough, but got a start in the book business and opened up a store up in North County. And a young man who left me to go to San Francisco and opened up and ran for a number of years, a good little antiquarian shop in the Bay Area, but sold it and went into the ministry. And that one kind of shook me up a bit. But all of it, delightful, good bookmen, and we hoped that others would come along and move down the line to start their own stores, because it is kind of a dying industry. It's not what we call a growth industry. As to the future of the business, as I mentioned, it's, I can sum it up this way. A number of years ago, Hans Conried, the actor, came to San Diego and he became very active in some projects at the zoo, and he found our store, and he was quite a bibliophile. And he was in the store and visiting with us. In those days, we were open later evenings, Fridays and Mondays. But he came in the store and he said, you know, he said, you've chosen the business of being an antiquarian bookseller, and I've chosen that of being a legitimate stage actor. And our combined talents have all the public demand of that as if we were dirigible drivers. Which makes you stop and think, why do you stay in it? Well, there's always a need for it, and it's an interesting work. It's nothing that you're going to ever get wealthy in, because there's seldom few that do within the book business. But the idea of selling the right book to the right person and getting a small profit for it and going on to the next one is an intriguing and interesting situation. Life every day is an interesting thing. Now, I think maybe I could conclude here and say if there's some questions I could ask, answer, or if there's some deep, mysterious secrets that I could possibly lay aside and tell you the reality of, I'd be glad to do that to my ability. I've done a very good job. Well, I have a question here.
To what extent do you deal in rare books, distinguish used books now, and how do you tell the difference?
The question is, to what extent do we deal now with rare books as opposed to general books, and how do I tell the difference? The rare book, and again, when you talk about books, you talk about the demand factor of a book. A rare book doesn't have to be old. I'll stop and mention this little thought when we get to talking about books. Between the period of the invention of the movable type, the Gutenberg Bible, and the year 1503, the so-called incunabular incubum period, some estimates claim, and probably rightly so, 20 million books published, an awful lot of books. So age really doesn't mean anything as to a rare book. Today, in percentage of dollars, we are doing about 32% rare books. Now, I'm going to put that in with the cataloging and the rare book business, the balance of it being the general used book and new book business. And as to how you tell the difference, well, the interesting thing is sometimes I can't. I have